I think for whatever reasons, I've always had a problem with authority. I've always had a deep mistrust of anyone claiming to either know sort of the secret of something or even codified knowledge, which is something I ran into plenty when I went to business school. Like, hey, here's how you run a successful business. And I always kept thinking, like, I don't know, man. Like, this stuff we're learning right here, that just seems like one sliver for one slice of time, and usually a slice of time that's not now, and usually a sliver that's not me, or I can't relate to. And I think perhaps that's some of it too, that a lot of what I was sort of taught in business school and school in general, I couldn't relate to it. Like, it didn't feel like that applied to me. And that came to a lot of the rules about how you're supposed to build a business and so forth. So I think the foundation of a lot of the work that we're doing is basically just that deep-seated mistrust of learning from other people's experiences. So we basically reverted to first principle. Like, I'm going to learn as much as I can from my own experiences, which I know on a sort of societal level is that's perhaps not that great. And I mean, if you try to figure everything out from scratch, are you going to come up with something that's as good as what other people have spent decades or millennia perfecting? Well, in a lot of cases, perhaps yes, it is. Because perhaps right now, all those lessons from two decades ago just don't apply right anymore. And being taught them actually make you worse off than not knowing them at all.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. David, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. So, you know, it's interesting because I came across you by way of our mutual friend, Mike Rohde, but I also had, heard about your work and listened to you on the Stanford Entrepreneurial Thought Leader series. Obviously, you know, being a co-founder of 37 Signals, you're quite well known probably by a lot of people, maybe not necessarily by some in our audience. And ever since I heard that talk, I was really intrigued by, you know, the way you see the world and the way you look at business and everything about your story. So on that note, can you tell us a bit about your story, your journey, your background, and how that has brought you to everything that you're up to in the world?
Sure. It's definitely a bit of a tale. Well, I'm from Denmark originally. I moved to the U.S. in 2005. By then, I had been working with Jason Fried, my business partner at Basecamp, formerly 37 Signals, already for a couple of years. And that sort of snowballed the whole thing. And it was really by chance. So I was a reader of the Signal versus Noise blog, which is the company weblog of 37 Signals that was started back in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I think I started reading that blog around, actually, 1999 or maybe 2000. And at some point, I think in 2001, Jason had posted a couple of questions on the blog, just basically saying, hey, I'm trying to learn PHP. Can you help me figure this stuff out? I think it was pagination or something like that. And being a fan of the blog, I just wrote Jason an email and said, hey, sure, I'd be happy to help. Here's how you do this, and the other thing. And we started trading emails back and forth. And before we knew it, Jason had basically decided, maybe it's easier just to hire this Dane from Copenhagen than it is to actually figure out how to do programming. So I started working with Jason back in 2001. I was still in Copenhagen. We hadn't even spoken on the phone. This was all just email and instant messenger back in 2001. And we started working on, what was it? Oh, yeah. Jason had, back in the beginning of the mid-90s, he had been working on FileMaker Pro software that he was selling on his own, basically a shareware software. It was software for managing your collection of different things, managing your collection of music or books or whatever. And he wanted to basically bring that online. So we worked together on this app called Single File. It's a way to track your book collection, who you lent your books out to, which books you had, so on and so forth. And that went really well. We launched it. Some people liked it. Never really took off, but it was the first project we did together, and then we just started working together. Jason had the 37 Signals company, I think four people there at the time, and they were doing all this web design work, and a fair number of those web design clients didn't already have programmers on staff, so enter me. I would do the program work for that. And that went on for, a couple of years. And a couple of years in, then I think 2003, we kind of just realized that the way we were managing these projects were not sufficient. Things would get dropped. We wouldn't really be on top of things. It would look unprofessional to the customer. They wouldn't know where to go to get the latest updates on their project and so forth. And we thought, hey, we know how to build software. Can't we build some software to solve this problem? And that was the beginning of Basecamp. And the beginning of Basecamp was also the beginning of Ruby on Rails, which is another thing I've started. So in 2003, we were going to start on this Basecamp thing, this project management tool. And this was the first project in a while for me where we didn't have any technical dictates. Like, there was no client saying, hey, you have to make this in PHP, or you have to make it in Java, or you have to make it in Perl, or whatever people were making at the time. This was all open-ended. So I thought, hey, great. Greenfield opportunity, brand new app. I could try something. And at that time, I'd been reading Martin Fowler and Kent Beck and Dave Thomas and actually not so much Kent Beck. I don't think Kent was into Ruby at the time. Anyway, Martin Fowler and Dave Thomas were big proponents of Ruby, the programming language out of Japan. And in 2003, that was not a popular language whatsoever. But these guys have been writing about it in IEEE magazine and a few other industry magazines. So I thought, hey, I have the chance to do whatever I want. These guys really seem to like Ruby and all wish that they could use Ruby in a professional setting, but for various reasons their clients won't let them. I'm going to use Ruby. And what I found two things. First, I found that I was going to give myself the challenge that in 1 week I'd see how far I could get. And actually, I think I said in 1 month even. And after 1 week, I had realized, holy smokes, Ruby is blowing my mind in ways I thought about programming in a whole different light after just 1 week of exposure to Ruby. And this was after having programmed to some extent and in some capacity for a couple of years already. And I just thought, this is exactly what I've been looking for. This speaks to all my sensibilities, all my sort of leanings on design. This is amazing. And then it didn't really matter that A, not a lot of people were using it, and B, even less of those people have actually used it to build web applications. I thought this was just such a great language. It fit my brain so incredibly well. Not only my brain, it felt like I was coming home. Like I found my tribe. Here was a group of people, and Matt in particular, the creator of the language, that cared about the programmer before he cared about the machine. And I know that has echoes throughout the history of programming, but nobody was really saying it and putting it into those terms as Matt's was at the time. And not only putting it into those terms in terms of how he's speaking about the language, but you could just feel it from the language that was what he cared about. So I adopted Ruby wholehearted, and I started building Basecamp in it. And as I was building Basecamp, I needed all the stuff that just wasn't available in Ruby, all the stuff that we take for granted in a modern web development world today, all the libraries for talking to a database and generating HTML and all that stuff. I just started building it myself. And I found that that came very natural to some extent to me. I really like building my own tools because I'm very particular about my tools and what I enjoy using and how I enjoy using it, and it has to be just right. And there's no better way to getting it just so, just right than just basically making your own stuff. So that went on for about 6 months or so, and we released the first version of Basecamp in February of 2004, something like that. And then I released the first version of Ruby on Rails about 3 or 4 months later, also in 2004. So that's basically the genesis story of both Basecamp and Ruby on Rails, probably the two things I'm most known for and the two things I still spend the vast majority of my time on 11 years later.
Hmm. All right. So one of the things I want to do is go into the journey before the journey, sort of, you know, your moments of significance, early childhood and formative experiences growing up that actually led you down this path.
Sure. Well, it's kind of funny because I've always been into computers. I got my first, I think I got my first exposure to computers. That was the Commodore 64. a friend living on the same street as me, I think, when were we, like 4 or 5 years old or something like that? Probably five, I think. I have this memory of playing Yi'er Kung Fu. I don't know if you know that game, but it's like a early fighting game for the Commodore 64. I think it was released in, I don't know, 82 or something. And I remember sitting around like the TV screen this Commodore 64 was hooked up to. And here we were, like all the kids on my street, maybe 5 or 6 of us, each taking our turn to play this. And I just thought like, wow, this is just such an amazing world. Like playing computer games is just incredible. Like I'd spend as much time as I possibly could on it. And then I think maybe a year later, I didn't quite get the computer that I wanted. I wanted a Commodore 64, but my dad was working on fixing TVs and always sort of trading hi-fi equipment with people. And somehow he had traded and bartered his way to an Amstrad 646, I think it was called. So I got my first computer at 6 and just loved playing with it. I dabbled a little bit in programming, which basically meant at the time I typed in programs for magazines. That was how we did it. Like, you didn't distribute software as actual executable code at the time. You distributed text, printed text, and then somebody else typed it in. But what's funny is that actually didn't go that much further. Like, I was not one of those kids that got into programming and just started programming at year 6. Not at all. I dabbled with it just to the extent of, like, I knew how to type in a program and I knew how to execute it and so forth. And I kept playing with computers. I kept playing video games for years to come. But I never really got into programming, which is funny because a little later, maybe when I was 14 or something, I think that's another milestone, I went to a demo party. In Europe, there was a very active demo scene where people would make basically sort of computer music videos on both the Commodore 64, but at that time, the Amiga. And it was basically just about making these sort of elaborate graphical demonstrations. And there was this huge party called The Party in a city in Denmark that was the largest gathering of demo programmers and hangarounds of the scene. I love how these things just sort of claim these words. Like, it was The Party, and the whole thing was called The Scene. Anyway, so I arrived at this place. I don't remember if I actually knew anyone. Maybe I somehow I'd heard it from someone or something. But anyway, at this party, I dragged my Amiga 500 and my TV across the country, basically on a train, because, I mean, it's not like we had laptops or anything. You had to bring physically your computer. So I brought it to this huge hall in this small town in Denmark called Aarhus, I think. And it was just this huge hall, and there was like, I don't know, 2,000 people in there. And I set up my thing on one of the desks. And somehow I just met all the people in computers that I would know for the next, I still know a bunch of these people, but everyone who would otherwise have an impact on me learning computers more definitely at this one event. Mm-hmm. Like, accidentally just sitting down at the right table. I met Alan Odgaard, the creator of TextMate, there at age 14. I met a bunch of other Danish scene programmers and demo coders that I would later end up working with once I graduated high school in a web shop. Just a bunch of people at this one magical party, this one conference, which was really funny. But what was funny still too was, so I met all these people, a bunch of them were programmers, a bunch of them were demo programmers, like hardcore assembler writing programmers. And still, I didn't pick up programming. Like, I was still sort of on the edges. I spent my time in the scene trading. Like, I ran a pirated software bulletin board, a BBS back in the day. It was called Electronic Confusion. And I ran that at like age 15. I had like three phone lines coming into my tiny little room in my parents' house, and actually paying for it, selling pirated CDs. So I was sort of around the scene and involved in all this stuff and involved with computers, but again, didn't learn how to program really until late 90s, maybe 98, 99. Was when we sort of moved away from the BBS world and started working on websites. And I was still into games, so it was gaming websites, and I just sort of very slowly got into it, first learning Microsoft ASP, then learning some PHP, and then from there it went. But by the time I really sort of knew enough about programming to say, well, I can program, I was 20 or 21.
We're never going to agree on everything, but I think we can all agree that we could all use more sleep. In fact, sleep is one of those factors that plays a major role in your productivity, your creativity, and your overall performance. And getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need an expensive new mattress or sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from a pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they get even softer over time. You can buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple of hundred bucks. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews, and Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, and Fast Company are all talking about Boll & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund. But I doubt that you'll want to send them back. There's no risk and no reason not to give them a try. To get you started right now, for our listeners, they're offering $50 off your first set of sheets at BollAndBranch.com. And use the promo code creative. Again, go to bollandbranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com with the promo code creative. Again, just visit bollandbranch.com and enter the promo code creative for $50 off your first set of sheets.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do you think that so many people remain on the edges of things like this before diving into them?
It's really interesting, I think. Part of it was that I entered into a group that was much older than me. I mean, I showed up at this party, I was 14. The other people there were, I don't know, 17, 18, 19, 20, or older. So they sort of, they already knew it. Like, they had already figured it out. And I don't know, there was just something about entering in with that group, and I just didn't know this stuff, that I couldn't. That didn't really work. Like, one of the things I think about often is this research into what's called complementary skills. Like, how in a family, for example, if a brother or sister or whatever picks up one skill and gets really good at it, it kind of influences what the rest of the family does. And then oftentimes, like, nobody else picks up that skill because that group already has that skill. It's more valuable if they pick up some other skill, something that the group doesn't have already. So that's kind of what I did. Like, I picked up, like, all right, I'm going to run the BBS for this. I'm going to get us all the software and trade all this stuff. Because nobody's doing that in my group right now, so let me have a swing at that.
Do you think that you could have known at the time that these people were going to have such a significant impact on the work you ended up doing with your life? Or do you think that's only something you recognize now in retrospect?
Good question. I think it's all retrospective. How do you know that you show up at some party at 14 and, like, the people you happen to meet, not because you set out to meet them, but just because they happen to sit next to you at some table, were the people that were going to sort of help influence your path from there. And part of it, too, is, of course, so they were there and they helped influence it, but there were so many other factors that have to play in, which is why I always think it's sometimes silly, sometimes grandiose to try to extrapolate too much from, oh, I did this thing and this other thing, so that means if you do either of those things or if you get involved in that way, that's going to lead to the same result. It's kind of like, it's funny, I just get this image of chaos theory, and whenever I think of that, I think of, like, that scene from Jurassic Park where, like, he lets the drop fall in the glass of water and sort of like, oh, these, all these ripples, how can we predict that they're going to happen just that way? that's often how I feel about the past, though. Like, how can you predict that all these things that have to happen in just that way and just that order leads to that effect? Like, how much can you really extract and extrapolate from that and use it as any helpful guide to whether the people should do or what they should look for?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I can't imagine you would, you know, think being a reader of this blog, you would end up being, you know, this incredible contributor to co-founding this company.
Exactly. Like, is that actionable even? I think that's what I like about, like, hey, just go read some blogs, and if one of the co-founders of the company asks for help, write them an email. And you can't extract lessons that are that specific, I think. I think you can extract other lessons, perhaps, that are much more generic and vague and perhaps not as actionable, about sort of just being kind and helpful and curious and all that stuff. But that's also trite. Like, who would say, oh, I don't want to be helpful. I don't want to be curious. I don't want to be kind. Like, everyone will say, oh, yeah, I'll do those things. So it's one of those things where I think over the years I've gotten less and less, I don't know, interested in trying to extrapolate those specific lessons on sort of a life arc and say, hey, here's something you can use that you can apply.
Well, my ongoing phrase is that, you know, you get a compass, not a map.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it.
Well, let's do this. Let's shift gears a little bit, and let's talk specifically about the way you guys have built this company, because I mean, you guys really have sort of pioneered an entirely different way of building companies, about thinking about business. I mean, I've read your books, and you definitely don't do things by the book, by any, you know, by any measure. I mean, that was one of the things that kept me hooked on the talk that you gave at Stanford about forgetting everything you learned in business school. And I thought, yeah, this guy knows what he's talking about, considering I've been to business school. And I'd love for you to talk about that in more depth.
Sure. I think I want to start with basically, this term, problem with authority. And it's usually bandied around as like, that's a bad thing. Like, if a kid has problems with authority, like, you gotta watch out. Like, this is something they should fix. Well, I think for whatever reasons, I've always had a problem with authority. I've always had a deep mistrust of anyone claiming to either know sort of the secret of something, or even codified knowledge, which is something I ran into plenty when I went to business school. Like, hey, here's how you run a successful business. And I always kept thinking, like, I don't know, man. Like, this stuff we're learning right here, that just seems like one sliver for one slice of time, and usually a slice of time that's not now. And usually a sliver that's not me, or I can't relate to. And I think perhaps that's some of it too, that I just, a lot of what I was sort of taught in business school and school in general, I couldn't relate to it. Like, it didn't feel like that applied to me. And that came to a lot of the rules about how you're supposed to build a business and so forth. So I think the foundation of a lot of the work that we're doing is basically just that deep-seated mistrust of learning from other people's experiences. So we basically reverted to first principle. Like, I'm going to learn as much as I can from my own experiences, which I know on a sort of societal level is that's perhaps not that great. And I mean, if you try to figure everything out from scratch, are you going to come up with something that's as good as what other people have spent decades or millennia perfecting? Well, in a lot of cases, perhaps, yes, it is. Because perhaps right now, all those lessons from 2 decades ago just don't apply right anymore. And being taught them actually make you worse off than not knowing them at all. So that was that skepticism I had all along going through business school. I went to Copenhagen Business School, what an original name for school, and got all this sort of standard teachings on finance and organizational theory and information system design and all this stuff. And at the same time, I just kept thinking, it's not that I know better necessarily. It's not that I already know this stuff. Like, that's another charge you often hear, right? Like, oh, he thinks he knows everything. Mm-hmm. I didn't think I knew everything at all. I knew that what they were telling me wasn't right. I don't know how that comes. Maybe that sounds just as arrogant, but I thought, like, I don't know. I'm going to figure this stuff out on my own. And that's what we tried to do. Just figure everything out as though there was not already a rule book in place. Just test everything out on, does that feel right for me? Does that, could we do that simpler? Could we not do that? Jason has a great story from when 37 Signals got started, where they would start by writing these big proposals to clients, because that's what everyone was doing at the time. They would write like a 20-page proposal with wireframes and all this stuff. And he kept thinking, like, that seems like a lot of work, and are we really getting value out of this? Is this really valuable that I'm spending a week writing this huge report? Is anyone really reading it? So he went from 20 pages to 10 pages, and like, nobody complained. He went from 10 pages to 5 pages. Nobody complained. He went from 5 pages to 1 page that basically said, like, hey, this is who we are. This is how much it's going to cost. This is when it's going to be done. Guess what? Nobody complained. Not only did nobody complain, everyone were happy. And it's just, I think, such a perfect example of, like, hey, this is the status quo. Everyone's writing these big proposals because they think that's what the client want. Well, client didn't want that. Client just wanted to know, when is it going to be done? How much is it going to cost? And do I trust you to do the work? That was the three bits of information that they needed, right? So there's a lot of that in business and, well, in my opinion, and in life, mm-hmm. where people are basically cargo culting. They think, like, hey, I watched this guy do this or this organization do that. They're successful. That must mean that this method that they're using is good and fits for me. Mm-hmm. Couldn't disagree more. And I think that that's why sort of that talk at Stanford Business School about unlearning your MBA was really targeted at that, right? That a lot of things you learn in an MBA program or any other business school program are things that were codified in book by huge companies. Like, what does it take to run GE? What does it take to run IBM? And then they present these lessons and methods as though they were general applicable business ideas that you can apply this to a company of five people. And what I found through my experience is that exactly the opposite is true. That if you try to apply the methods and learnings of a 100,000 people organization to an organization of five, mm-hmm. you will do great harm to that organization. And it will be worse than not knowing this stuff at all. And I find that the missteps that, well, I've made and I observe other people making are very often not that they don't know how to do it, but that they know a way that isn't so. Or they know a way that's actively harmful. And they picked up that way from school or book or watching something. They're misapplying something, a pattern, where the context doesn't match. And that's where people very often get in trouble. So we've then tried to basically say, okay, we're just going to consider our own context. We're not going to try to reapply patterns from other contexts to us. And then, I mean, in some ways, ironically enough, right? We bundled all those impressions and experiences up in our own book. And then we sold it as like, hey, this is the way to do things.
Yeah.
Which the irony of that is not lost on me. But I do think that what is interesting is the feedback that we're getting is that a lot of the messages that we're putting out is very much, hey, trust your own instincts. Uh-huh. Instincts aren't always right, absolutely far from it, but very often they're better than trusting the application of a pattern that doesn't fit your context.
Today's episode of The Unmistakable Creative is sponsored by Squarespace. It's the beginning of the year, and chances are that you have a creative project or idea that you want to get off the ground this year. Whether it's writing a book, starting a blog, or building a business, Squarespace can help. They have beautiful templates created by world-class designers, powerful e-commerce functionality that lets you sell anything online, the ability to customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks, and everything is optimized for mobile out of the box, and they have built-in search engine optimization and 24/7 award-winning customer support. A dream is just a great idea that doesn't have a website yet. Make it a reality with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code UNMISTAKABLE to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Huh. Okay, so lots of really interesting stuff here, and I've read both of your books, so I think that's really hilarious that you said the irony is not lost on you. And I happen to agree with that idea of looking at something and extrapolating, you know, generalized lessons. I mean, I think that happens in the world of the individual content creator online too, right? You see, hey, here's a course on how to build a popular blog. Here's my step-by-step formula. And what I often see is people follow that formula to the letter, assuming they're going to get the same result. And when they don't, they're very disappointed. And I have always said, that's because you're following the damn formula to the letter. It's, you know, I said, you know, you have to model these people, not mimic them.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I think one of the hardest lessons for humans to not understand, because I think most people understand them, but to internalize and actually follow is that past performance is not a predictor of future results. I mean, you get that in small print on every financial booklet and so on, and nobody follows it ever. Everyone always thinks past performance equals future results. And I think it's just hardwired into our DNA to follow that. And it requires just immense sort of opposition, conscious opposition, and constant reminding that that's not true, that's not true, that's not true. And then next day, you try to do the same thing. You try to follow something that worked in the past, and you're like, what? Why doesn't it work today?
Uh-huh.
Oh, past performance.
Okay, so I want to ask you two questions about this. A lot of this, I think, is the byproduct of a lot of cultural conditioning, right? I mean, think about how we are raised in school to follow instructions and get good grades and repeat and regurgitate and learn from the people who are supposedly better than us. And I'm really interested in hearing, one, how you guys start to break this conditioning. I mean, I can only imagine. My guess is by the time somebody comes to work for you, this is not part of the way they think, because they probably wouldn't even get through your hiring process. But I'm just interested in how people start to break this conditioning in their own lives, because I think it's so ingrained into us that often we're in a prison of our own creation and we don't even realize it.
Couldn't agree more. I think the hardest step is to realize that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. The hardest step is to realize that you've been conditioned, that you've been sort of gamed and set up in ways that are not good for you. And I think the school system is certainly one place of doing it. Another, I'll return to that in a second, but another aspect that you just reminded me of was, so my wife, Jamie, is from the US, I'm from Denmark. And one of the things, I mean, she's obviously a very bright person who sort of figured a lot of stuff out, which she hadn't figured out perhaps until we started exploring this stuff together, was just how ingrained American indoctrination is. And I think that perhaps that's a, at least for Europeans, is a easier way to look at it, because it's easier to recognize, because it's easier to recognize something that's not new. It's just the propaganda machine that sort of works on people, and how sort of you get indoctrinated in American exceptionalism and so on. But I think the same is true in the school system, and there's all these insidious techniques that traditional schooling apply to you. The whole notion of carrots and sticks, the whole notion of extrinsic motivation, grades and tests and all these things are just so incredibly harmful. And I think one of the ways I broke that for me personally was to realize that failing a test, like the world didn't end. Like for whatever reason, fairly early on, like I had some subjects that I was good at, that I cared about and I was interested in. And then I had other subjects that I, for either entirely or for periods of time, I didn't care about and I wasn't interested in, so I failed them. And I thought that's probably been one of the most instructive events, is to realize that getting a bad grade doesn't mean anything. In fact, getting a mediocre grade, many of the mediocre grades I've gotten during my schooling were the grades that I was by far the most proud of. Because it taught me that effort and output is not proportionate. That I could get what amounts to maybe a C or a B minus with 5% of the effort it took to get an A. And in a lot of subjects, like a B minus was just fine. Like, who's going to care? Like, you think anyone walks up to me today, hey, what did you get in English in high school? Nobody gives a shit, right? But at the time, when you're in it, when you're a student there, like, there's so much pressure to, like, oh, especially, I mean, I find it even more ridiculous in the U.S., the whole, like, oh, you're a straight-A student. I mean, just straight-A, and my wife was a straight-A student, and valedictorian, all that shit. And I just look at that, and in some ways, I just pity it. I pity people who have straight A's. I think of that and just think, like, what a waste. What a waste of your life and time. Like, it's such a shortened moment where you're sort of growing up and should be learning about all sorts of other things than just what happens in school sort of at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. But when you've been conditioned to thinking that straight A is somehow the sort of pedestal of living at that time, I mean, you just forgo so many things, and you just it conditions you in really unhealthy ways, I think. So I think I'm a father myself now, and I really hope that when Colt grows up, like, he's not a straight A student. I'll need to have a chat with him if he starts getting straight A's. There should be some mix-ups there. There should be some stuff that he chooses. Like, you know what? I'm not interested in that. I'm not going to apply myself in that. Or I'm going to apply 5% of what I could do in that, and I'm going to get my B-, and that's going to be great, and I'm going to do a whole lot of other stuff outside of school mm-hmm. that's not in fucking some college prep program or checklist that I have to fill up to get into some retarded fucking Ivy League school. See, now you get me all wind up. Because what I learned during sort of both high school and I don't know what ninth grade is called in US, I think junior high or something. What I learned was that when I only applied those 5%, like, I had 95% left over. I could do all sorts of really interesting, cool stuff with that. Like, I could run a BBS out of my room. I could sort of be involved in all these communities. I could do all these other things that were not connected to school. And through high school, same thing. I started running these gaming websites. I started sort of learning about the internet and getting involved with all these things. None of that was on the curriculum. And I wouldn't have had time for any of it if what I was trying to do was a straight A shot. And yeah, so I think that's just a waste of time. Straight A's waste of fucking time. And the thing too is it doesn't play out. Like, the number of people that I know who've sort of quote unquote gotten success, the correlation between that and their academic record or whether they're straight A's, very low. I'd actually say that a large number of straight A students that I've met, like, are the people who end up in sort of that path of, like, oh, then you become a lawyer. Uh-huh. And a lot of lawyers end up hating, like, wait, why did I become a lawyer? Oh, that was the path you were supposed to take once you got straight A's and got into a good college and so forth. And they wake up one day and they realize, shit, what happened? Well, I don't give a shit about writing some stupid-ass contract for some corporation. I want to do something more meaningful with my life. And not meaningful in the grand scheme of saving the world, but just something that I care about, something intrinsic. And I think that that's what the straight-A whole thing beats out of you, that it's all about extrinsic value, that it's not about learning subjects and getting good at something and remembering things. It's about just beating the test. And what a miserable fucking way of living your life when that's the purpose of your being. Beating somebody's own or beating somebody else's measure of success, mm-hmm. I can't imagine a worse hell. Which is why, since being conditioned to that and sort of trying to reject that as hard as I could, and I wasn't entirely successful either, I've learned that the most important thing for my continued happiness is to define my own parameters of success. Hmm. Whenever I accept somebody else's measurement stick for what is good or what is successful, it's extrinsic, and I end up not being happy about it.
Wow. So let's talk about this in more depth. One of the things that's interesting to me, you know, we've talked about it in the context of growing up and getting rid of that conditioning from schooling. But now we live in a world where our lives are so publicly on display that every success and every failure pretty much makes its way to your newsfeed. And I'm interested in hearing your perspective on this, you know, from the standpoint of you know, founders who struggle with things like founder depression, which you're hearing so much more of, and, you know, people are finally starting to admit these kinds of things and dealing with those kinds of failures and, you know, actually navigating them and coming out of the other side of it, having grown from it rather than being demolished by it. Does that make sense?
Yep, and I think it ties back to what we were just talking about. I think a lot of, and you know, I'm just extrapolating, I'm not a psychologist, I talk to everyone with depression, but I think a lot of it ties back to what you expect to happen. Like, if you go into it with this extreme pressure, I was going to write this up today, this notion of hunger. Mm-hmm. Like, we talk about this all the time. Oh, entrepreneurs need to be hungry. Fuck no. You make terrible decisions on an empty stomach. Like, you shouldn't be hungry. I keep hearing this starvation motivation spiel, usually from people who are not hungry at all, who are very fat and happy on top of their mountain of VC cash, right? Like, it's very easy to tell other people that they should go hungry then. But I think that really ties into it, that when you sort of put this pressure cooker on, like, oh, you should be so hungry, and like the hungry people and the people who work the hardest are the ones that win. No, it's not. Oftentimes it's just fucking the luckiest person that wins. I say that, and then there's like a huge asterisk afterwards, like that. I mean, obviously that's not the only thing. Like, you can't just not apply yourself at all and then just
right.
expect to be lucky and then something's going to happen. But you can absolutely apply your very best and your all, be smart and be all the things it takes to have success and not have success. It happens all the time. But people have a way of digesting the narrative that if they don't have success, it's because of their somehow like inadequateness as a human being. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, that's a pretty depressing thought. Like,
yeah.
I'd probably get depressed too if that was how I thought of the world. So I've tried, again, constantly to redefine like what is success. Because if I define it in such a way where I cannot lose, I can't get depressed.
Wow.
So I define it in such a way, for example, right now, right? Because I find it doesn't end. It doesn't end at all. Even when people do have supposed success, they start just becoming afraid of new things and other things, like losing that success. In mm-hmm. fact, many times that's even worse than the fear of not being successful at all, is the success of losing what you have.
Yeah.
And one of the techniques that I've applied to that, like, I don't feel any that there's anything odious about saying, like, I have a lot of shit to lose. Built a successful company over 11 years, still run a successful open source project after 11 years. Like, I got a lot of nice stuff. Like, if I was afraid of losing that all the time, which I think a lot of people are, they are afraid of losing the nice stuff, mm-hmm. then it'd be very easy to sort of apply that pressure cooker to yourself. So I just keep thinking always about, like, hey, if I lost it all, okay, that'd be fine. Like, I'd still be able to do many of the things I enjoy the most in the world. I'd still be able to program. Like, it doesn't matter whether I've gone bankrupt or whatever. I'd still be able to program. I'd still be able to play with my son. I'd still be able to do all these other things that, these are the things that really make me happy anyway. So this loss can't really hurt me. And I had the same thing from the outset. Hey, if this base camp is not going to be successful, so what? I just learned how to program. I just launched a new app. I learned all these other things. Like, would I look back at that time and say that I regretted that time? Absolutely not. I think that's where the problem comes in. The problem comes in when people invest an awful lot of their time and ego into something where it only pays off if it pays off. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, it only pays off if it's a success. If it's not a success, they have to look back at those 5 years and go, Jesus, I wish I'd told that asshole of a VC to go fuck himself. Like, but I didn't. And it didn't work anyway. Like, that didn't even help me that I didn't.
Yeah.
And now, like, that's worth being depressed over. Right? When you supplant your intrinsic motivations with these extrinsic goals, you're a prisoner to them. And when things don't pan out the way the always to the sky chasing hockey chart of success is supposed to look like, you look back at that and just feel regret. And I think that that's a terrible feeling, which is why people often ask me, like, oh, if you look back at like 10 years you've been doing this, like, what do you regret the most, or what are some of the biggest mistakes you've had? Like, honestly, and maybe this is selective memory, which I think is always very helpful in guarding your own happiness too, but I look back and I'm like, I don't regret a thing. I don't regret anything. There was really not anything I would have done differently. And that's not to say, like, oh, we did everything perfectly. Obviously, it's not. Like, we could have done a lot of things that perhaps we would have had more success, or would have done different things or whatever. It's just a mindset. I can't look at the past and my path from A to B and sort of like, oh, these are all these things that I regret, and then still feel good about the work that I'm doing and feel good about the work going forward.
Yeah, you know, when I hear you say that, I think about this blog post that I wrote on my blog this morning titled "The Infinite Value of Things That Can't Be Measured," and you know, the idea that you have no regrets. And I think about this show, and I wonder at times, like, okay, if it didn't pay off in the way I expected it to, I've gotten to have 500 really fascinating conversations with people, and probably received an education that was far more valuable than anything I got in college or business school.
Absolutely. I think about the experience and the arc of 10 years with Basecamp in much the same way. Mm-hmm. That if Basecamp was to implode tomorrow, that, I don't know, we did something terrible that somehow ended the company, I had a 10-year run working with amazing people, building products that I really liked, using tools that I truly enjoyed, serving customers that I cared for. How is that a bad run?
Yeah.
How is that something to look back on with regret? And I think when you can't answer yes to that, when you're not working with tools you enjoy, you're not working with people you love working with, when you're not serving customers that you absolutely enjoy serving, you have to supplant that with something extrinsic. Well, I did it and I made $1 million, or I don't know, or I guess, sorry, $1 million is petty change these days. I guess $1 billion is what you're supposed to say, right?
Yeah.
I made $1 billion and that made it all worth it. I mean, Jesus fuck. Not me.
Yeah.
How can companies and organizations do unmistakable work? Well, there are a few ways, but it involves going outside the regular standard operating procedures, and that scares companies. In a culture of uniformity, it's intimidating to choose to stand out, but I really do believe that creativity is one of the most underutilized assets in most companies, and this puzzles me because creativity applied in business directly translates into innovation. Speaking is one of the few avenues where I get to share these ideas in person rather than online. Think my message might be a good fit for your event or organization? Get in touch at unmistakablecreative.com/speak. Again, that's unmistakablecreative.com/speaking.
Well, let's do this. I want to spend the last part of our conversation distilling the principles from your books and into the principles that you guys run your business by for people who are not familiar with your work.
Sure. It's funny when you sort of put on the spot, like, what are the principles that I would sort of pull up and say, like, oh, this is the one that really governs it all. I mean, we can talk about some of the specifics from Rework.
Yeah, that's what I figured would be the most relevant to our listeners.
Sure. So one of the topics that's gotten a lot of play for a long time is this notion that work, the modern workplace, is a interruption factory, that the sanctity of getting shit done is constantly being violated in almost every office that you can work in today. And a lot of that comes from meetings, getting pulled in to meetings, because meetings are great, right? Like, collaboration is always great, and you can't have enough collaboration. That's where the magic happens. Absolutely not. Meetings are often incredibly toxic wastes of time, energy, and motivation. Over-collaboration is a real danger that I fear far more than under-collaboration in most contexts. The notion that we have to be sort of just constantly collaborating to get stuff done is just insidious in my mind. Yes, of course you have to figure out what you're working on and what you should be working on and which direction we're going. That stuff is incredibly important. And that takes about, or should in my mind, take about 10 to 15% of your time. Then there's the other 90 to 85% of your time where you're supposed to get the actual work done. And getting the actual work done, to me at least, that's where the true happiness lies. Like, I truly enjoy just doing the work. I think that goes back to that notion again, like, if you don't enjoy the work, if you're just doing the work because you want something else out of it, man, I pity you. Like, find something that you actually enjoy doing for the sake of itself. So for me, that was programming. I just really like to program. I should say that with some qualification. I really like to program Ruby. I really like to program web applications. There are other domains and tool sets where my enjoyment drops off significantly, but For what I'm doing, I really enjoy doing it. So I want to do that for long periods of uninterrupted time. That's how I get stuff done. And it's amazing just how much stuff you can get done if you have, say, 4 hours of basically no interruptions, no meetings you're getting pulled into. You're sort of turning off all those interruptions and just get stuff done. It's just that cloud. And that cloud, I think, comes from this notion of flow. There's a great book by an author, Mikhail, and I can't pronounce his last name, called Flow, that talks about these interviews that he's done with, I think, hundreds of people, where he talked about, like, what's your happiest state? And it basically all boils down to people's happiest state is this flow state. When you're working on problems where time and space sort of drift in the background and you're just working just beyond perhaps your capabilities or your current knowledge or how you figure things out, and you're learning something new and you're building something great, it's just bliss. And I think it's just a travesty how we make it so hard in many companies and workplaces to enter that zone. You cannot enter that zone if something is on your schedule or if somebody comes knocking on your door every 45 minutes or every hour and a half. It just will not happen. Like, you could try to squeeze work into these work moments. It's not a work day. And not getting a work day, this notion, this feeling of like a good day's work. Like, that, I really love that. Like, there's nothing more rewarding than sort of closing your computer at the end of the day and feeling like, that was a great work day. I really got something good done. I made progress. Like, that to me is bliss in that, what do you call it? Almost a common monotone sense of bliss. Sounds like a contradiction, but it's the bliss that you can have day in and day out. There's not a whole lot of other stuff like that, right? Most of the sort of things when people think about bliss or pure happiness, they think about these fleety, rare moments that only happen once every few months or once a year or something. Like, that's where you really capture the happiness or the vacation or whatever. Screw that. Like, you're working so much of your time. It's the majority of working hours for most people is that they're working, right? I want to make sure that that period is bliss, that is everyday happiness, and that in turn will translate into an overall satisfaction with life that's just unable or sort of impossible to reach otherwise. So Rework has a bunch of sort of techniques for trying to do that. Protecting that space, protecting your flow from meetings, interruptions, the workplace, your boss, your colleagues, and other forms of interruptions. And then the other part of it that we focus on is trying to soothe your natural fears of doing stuff like, oh, I don't know enough, or I don't have enough time, or I don't have enough money, or any of these other fear-based excuses that people usually sort of tell themselves or sort of get themselves wrapped up into and are the reasons why they are not feeling happy about the things that they're doing or never get started on doing anything at all. So if we take just one of those, for example, not enough money or not enough resources, right? Like, everyone always thinks like, oh, if I could just put together the perfect team, like, with money was no object and I could hire everyone I wanted, and there's just no constraints. If there were no constraints of my work, imagine what I could do. Yes, let's imagine that. There are plenty of organizations today who are in exactly that situation. Like, an example we've always used is Microsoft, right? Microsoft has all the money in the world. Like, their enterprise business is still a cash cow of epic proportions. Like, somebody within Microsoft can pitch an idea and get all the resources that they want. Is that the happiest place to work on earth, you think? I don't know. And I actually think that the opposite is true. That the happiest moments that I've had is when I've had not quite enough time, not quite as much of a team that I would want, all sorts of constraints on the expression, a frame. Like, when you just have a complete blank canvas and you can do and paint or use whatever tools that you want and take as long as you want, that is really hard. Like, it's like staring at that blank page and having writer's block. But when you have some very specific boundaries of, like, hey, we have three people to make this feature, and if it doesn't ship in 5 weeks, that's not going to be correct. So we're going to have to figure out a version of what it is that we're working on that fits those constraints. That is what I absolutely damn love. I love sort of having the constraints set up and then working within that space and then optimizing within that space. It's funny, tying back to the conversation we had earlier about the demo scene, it reminds me about some of the demos that that people would write back in the days. They had, I think it was 4 kilobytes. 4 kilobytes to make something happen inside of that, right? To make something, a cool graphic demonstration happen. That is some real damn constraints. We don't have those anymore on a technical level, but we absolutely still have them at organizational levels. And I really just enjoy that. And it's funny, when I talk to other entrepreneurs or business owners that are either still running the business or have sold their business, do you know what they all talk about? They don't talk about the now. They don't talk about the, oh, I sold the business, that was the moment of glow and bliss when the millions cleared into their bank account. Or if they're still running the business, they're not talking about, oh yeah, I have these, 15 staff meetings lined up for next week. I'm super duper excited about that. What they all talk about is the beginning. They all talk about the constraints. Oh, you remember when we were just like 8 people and like we had really to, although I kind of hate that word, hustle to get something shipped? That's what people look back on with affection. But these moments of constraints are really the moments of affection. And we don't know it at the time, and we don't even when we sort of reminisce about it later, most people don't draw the connection and think, hey, wait a minute, I could do that again. I could ensure that I keep setting myself up for situations that have constraints, and that's a way to produce flow and get happiness out of it. But yet there it is.
Wow. So I have two last questions for you. At this point, I mean, you guys have done very well. And I've asked this to a number of people who have reached a point of sort of significant wealth about how the accumulation of money or getting to a place of financial security to the point where you probably don't have to work again. You know, how has that changed your perspective on wealth and money?
It's funny because in some ways, I'm going to talk about it, but I want to preface it with, in some ways, like, it's conversations that most people won't touch with a 10-foot pole, I find, because it's toxic in a way that you can't explain to other people. Uh-huh. Like, I can't, it's very hard to explain or try to rationalize now that, like, my life is only marginally better now that I have this sort of, I don't have to work wealth. Uh-huh. Than it was when I was sitting in my little studio apartment in Copenhagen and making $15 an hour working for Jason on this single file app. Like, I've added 2%, right? Again, I understand that's not the situation. Like, if you're in abject poverty and you're a hard time sort of making ends meet to get food on the table, or if you have dependents, different situation. Right? A lot of people I talk to, they're not in those circumstances. So for those, they still think that this magic thing is going to happen when they have enough money not to need to work anymore, that like bliss is somehow just going to flow into their life and every day is going to be different. You know what? Not at all. It really isn't. And the first experience I had with that was Jeff Bezos made a minority investment back in, I can't remember when it was. It was 2006, where he bought a small chunk of Basecamp straight from Jason and me, which meant that both Jason and I all of a sudden had zeros that our bank account had never seen before, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking at the time, wow, this is going to be just so, imagine like what I could do with this money, or I wouldn't need to do, or whatever. And I thought about that for like a couple of days, and then the check cleared. And you know what? Then it was Monday. And it just didn't matter. Like, again, of course it mattered. It mattered at the edges, and I got to do some nice things and so on. But on that sort of what happens every day level, it just didn't really matter. And that's, I find that you can't tell somebody that. Like, nobody's willing to accept that on somebody else's experience, which is basically a topic that's kind of hard to talk about. Like, they all think, yeah, that's easy for you to say. Now you're fucking rich. right? And then all of a sudden, which is the other thing too, I find a lot of discussions online, they go like, some person has a problem or depressed or whatever, and then somebody says, well, the person is rich. What do they have to complain about? You know what? Like, the problems are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, they're not the same. There are different problems, and some problems are directly related to money. I accept that. For a lot of people who are sort of entrepreneurs or able to get good paying knowledge jobs, like, the difference is really much smaller, much, much smaller than most people would agree. Or maybe that's not true for all people. Maybe that's just my experience, right? Maybe I'm very unique in, like, not having had a sort of huge impact to my emotional well-being from going from not having a large bank account to having a large bank account. But I don't tend to think so. So the one thing I think that it has brought is sort of just this notion of calm. That comes from the fact that, like, oh, okay, so we won whatever game you want to call this game of, like, having success on a big bank account, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now that game is not there anymore. Even more clarity to just figure out, like, what is it that I actually want to do with my life? Like, a lot of people can put that off when they think, oh, I'm just going to work towards this goal. This goal is going to be this magic land of financial independence. And when I reach it, well, I don't really know what I have a plan for reaching it, but when I reach it, it's all going to be bliss, right? Like, so we got there, and it kind of looked the same as the day before and the day before that. So you realize, okay, that's not where a source of happiness is going to come from. I'm going to have to find it in much more mundane activities. And these mundane activities are exactly as we've been talking about, the intrinsic flow of just doing good work, working with great people, working on interesting problems, working with environments that you care about, and sort of trading it all off and having a nice balance. That life is not sort of about chasing something. It's not about being hungry. It's not about, like, oh, I want to eat something else. I want to eat something bigger. I want to get to that magic $1 billion, right? Like, how the hell is that going to change my life? Not at all, right?
Hmm. Well, I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Honesty, I'd say very often people could be so much more interesting to themselves, to others, if they were just honest. Like, if they weren't so afraid of, like, oh, how am I going to look if I say this? I find that that's the easiest hack that I found for sort of PR is on both a company and a personal level, just to be honest, telling things the way you see them. And, I mean, I guess some people's honesty is not a very pretty honesty, and maybe they should shut up, but most people, this honesty is actually really interesting. And most people have really interesting observations and thoughts and things they want to do and views in the world. They're afraid to share them because they think that they're going to make them look funny or weak or whatever. Once you get over that hump and stop sort of caring, oh, what's it going to look like if I say something stupid? Life gets better. It gets more interesting. Like, maybe this is self-serving because I have so little filter between my brain and my mouth that it serves me well to say that that that's what makes you interesting. But I really do believe it. I find that and this is even, I mean, we've been going at this for a long time now, right? Over a decade where we've been public personas saying things about things and thinking things about things in public. And from the get-go, I'd say both Jason and I were pretty honest and pretty forthright. But I feel like it just gets better the more honest, the more forthright, the more willing to admit mistake and flaws and opinion and so on that we get. And the more unmistakable it becomes because of it.
Hmm. David, this has been phenomenal. Really, really eye-opening and insightful and thought-provoking. Really, I think you're going to shift a lot of people's mindsets with a conversation like this. And I really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share all of this with our listeners.
This has been absolutely my pleasure. And I really I appreciate the optimism that you have. I've been trying to shift people's minds for over a decade now. And I think one of the things I've found is, like, you know what? People's minds shift when they're willing to and ready to shift them. Like, there's very little that somebody else can do. They can do a slight little nudge, and if we nudge some people, that's great. But actually turning somebody's mind on fundamental issues, that's an uphill battle. But maybe I'm just getting too old and too pessimistic about that. So I enjoy the optimism and Cool. Anyway, thanks a bunch for having me on. And yeah, I do hope that people enjoyed it. I think that's, I mean, I don't want to keep rambling on, but I think that that's often the best you can do. Like, even if people think, like, oh yeah, that might shift my mind, if they just enjoyed it, then at least they had a good time for an hour.
And yeah,
people's life is better if they have a good time for an hour.
Awesome. Well, for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member, who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.